Hello, and welcome to episode 62 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Jonathan Spike, former high school English teacher and now college-level instructional technology coach. He and I met at ISTE. He presented on the Ignite group with me, and he did an entire presentation on gamifying or game education or game-based learning, and it was really, really cool, and so I asked him to be on the show. Jonathan and I talk about instructional technology at the university level, the differences between public school and university education, the need for students to struggle and how they struggle at struggling, his Ignite presentation and what it was like to present, game-based learning, the fear we have in education of massive change, the benefits of de-emphasizing grades in the classroom, and bringing the outside world into your classroom. We cover a lot of topics and it's a really good chat. So, sit back and enjoy episode 62 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Jonathan Spike. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler, and today I'm excited because, you know, it's been about a month since ISTE wrapped up, at least as we're recording this. It's been about a month, and as you know, if you've listened to the podcast, I presented out there as part of the Young Educators Network Ignite sessions. Those really amazing, easy to create and not even remotely stressful 5-minute presentations that we do out at ISTE as part of a group. And at the end of that, I asked my fellow presenters if they would like to join me on the podcast and sit down and talk about their sessions and also the kind of stuff they like to talk about in education. And tonight I'm excited to have my first guest of the other Ignite panels join me on the show. And I have John Spike. How you doing, man?
I am doing wonderful, Brad. It's great to be on the show.
I appreciate it. And you sound wonderful, which is an improvement if you saw his speech. He informed us right before he went on as we were all like getting ready for rehearsal, like, yeah, totally woke up and didn't have a voice today.
Yeah, that was self-inflicted. I really love to sing. So obviously, if any of you listeners out there have been to ISTE, the EdTech Karaoke's the night before, and you're singing along with the bands, you know, previous nights we had gone to places where there was live music. And so I can't blame anybody but myself. That was on me.
Hey, it happens to the best of us. I can tell you that I went to the Young Educator Network social on Tuesday, and Wednesday I was definitely a sore in the throat from talking loudly and things like that as well. So I think it happens to all of us. It's part of the ISTE experience, I think.
Absolutely.
But if you could, for my audience, if you could give us an idea of who you are and what you're about and your position and that kind of stuff for us.
Absolutely. So I started as a high school English teacher, did that for about 3-4 years, moved on to, you know, I think districts all call them different things, tech coach, tech integrator, tech specialist, tech training, yada, yada. Did that for 3-4 years up. And I should say I'm from Wisconsin too, if you can't tell by my nasally accent. and so I did that up in the Green Bay area, of the state. And then, just took a job closer to where I grew up in South Central Wisconsin. It's, the University of Wisconsin Whitewater. And, basically there, my role is kind of do, help pre-service teachers and other staff in the college use technology. So I'm kind of trying to prep future teachers for kind of the types of technology that they'll use. They do let me, against their better judgment, teach a class each semester too. So I taught actually in the spring video games and learning, and it's like my dream come true teaching that class. And then in the fall, I'm teaching one called digital tools, mainly to pre-service librarians.
Yeah. Wow. A lot to unpack in there. I'm fascinated by this role you have. I think this is, I don't imagine this, at least from what I've seen interacting with teachers in their first year and in their internship programs, I don't think this is a common position for a university to have.
Yeah, it's really unique. And it's so funny because I had this flashback when I first read the job description, when I was thinking about applying. I read it and I go, oh my gosh, 2009 me thought like, man, this was a great program I went through. I went to UW-Madison for my undergrad to become an English teacher. Loved the program, but we weren't talking critically about using technology, and technology was starting to see a real renaissance in K-12. And I really felt unprepared. I was just kind of doing things because I was like, here's a really cool tech idea. What if I had my students create Facebook profiles for characters in 1984? Turns out that was super against Facebook's policy of creating, you know, fake names and all that. But I did anyways. And, you know, we weren't talking critically about it. So that's what I'm going to use to justify it. But I thought it would be really cool to go back someday and become like an instructor of technology for pre-service teachers. And then, you know, life takes funny turns. I'm sure you can relate to this, Brad. And sometimes what you thought you'd be when you grow up is something totally different. And I kind of fell back into that role that I kind of envisioned like 7-8 years ago.
Yeah, that is cool. So you're a digital coach, as I would call it, for a college, and but you have, it sounds like more, so in my experience, at least as a digital coach, I interact more directly with the teachers, but it sounds like you have more direct interaction with the students as well as the professors.
Yeah, it's interesting because they really did say to me, they're like, we want you to inform both because, you know, work yourself out of a job, you know, help our instructors get to a point where they feel competent as also those digital coaches, you know, having these conversations, you know, in the methods classes, in the foundations block, we call it, where we kind of set the basis for good practices in education. And so I definitely try to focus on the staff, but at the same time, you know, that comes with a lot of student interaction and making sure that they're comfortable utilizing tech. And they come down to our lab with ideas, questions about what they're doing in their student teaching. It's really fun and definitely something where I felt like that's what my program could have used. And then to have a college identify that, put out apps and be able to live that dream has been really exciting.
Hmm. And do you pop into college to other professors' classes, or is it more just that lab setting?
It is a little bit everything. And it's funny. I didn't know if I would be, you know, leaving K-12, it was a lot of different things. It was co-teaching. It was gradual release with instructors. It was going in there modeling and then having them, you know, try it when they got comfortable or just being on hand and giving them feedback on how something went. And at the college, it's definitely been come in and model and have them kind of try to replicate and take over slowly, and co-teaching has been the two that I've seen most popular, but I have gotten into others' classes. They have not been shy about that. And I think that's a testament to them seeing the value in it in the College of Ed.
Hmm. That's cool. So I'm fascinated by your position, but I'm also fascinated by this transition from, you know, from primary or K-12 up into the college environment. 'Cause to me, it always seems like this other world, this other place that they do their own thing. And how does that work for you? How do you feel about that transition? What is it like for you now that you're out of the K-12 public environment?
It is definitely different. And I would be lying if I said I didn't miss aspects of K-12, but I'd also say I'd be lying if I said, you know, you have a lot of opportunities afforded to you at higher ed, you know, that I didn't have a K-12 too. For one, like more funding, you know, we definitely have a little bit more leeway to try emerging tech. Whereas I felt like at K-12, if I couldn't get a grant for it, you know, it wasn't going to happen. But having said that, it was tough, and it was tough to walk away. And I definitely think they're two different worlds. But I think one thing that really cushioned the blow is I've talked to people who went to higher ed, and they served everyone at the college. They were doing digital training for everyone at the college. I am just focused on that College of Ed. And we also are called College of Ed and Professional Studies. So we have a little bit of communicative disorders in there. We actually have the military and aerospace, which is mainly our ROTC. So I actually, like, I'm doing some really unique stuff that I totally am learning along with, you know, the instructors on. But I think what cushioned the blow is they still have a little bit of that K-12 mindset, and they collaborate so much with K-12. That they get it. Whereas the rest of our college, some of the things I know I pushed, you know, I think would fall on deaf ears.
Hmm. Yeah. I think about my professors in my college experience, and I did not go through an education program, but I think about my college experience, and I don't believe that any of my professors would have been willing to let this tech coach pop into their class, or even would they reach out for assistance from I just don't imagine that being part of their mentality. So it does sound like you're in kind of a unique environment there.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. People told me, you're going to regret this. You're not going to get to do the things that you got to do at K-12. I had a lot of people say that, and people who are just not trying to scare me, but trying to be honest with me. And those were people who came from the wide swath where they were, you know, they maybe had, you know, associates or friends who went into, you know, some of that digital trainer roles who were trying to serve the entire population. But I do think we also, you know, not to toot, you know, my college's horn, you know, go Whitewater Warhawks, but we turn out the most teachers in the state of Wisconsin, you know, as a university. So we are very much focused on the training of teachers. You know, UW-Madison, where I graduate from, is very big into both research and turning out teachers. And so we are mainly focused on making sure our clientele go out there and are ready. And I think that really tells the instructors we need to get on board with what we're seeing at the school. So I do credit, I think my staff do a phenomenal job of embracing that.
So going the next step further, do you feel like a program like this, because I mean, you assume that a significant percentage of your graduates probably stay in that area. Do you feel like it is having a positive, do you feel like a better developed schooling experience for teachers is helping create better teachers? And is that being reflected in the actual data? Like, is that something people are talking about?
I know one thing that I've heard, and I've only been in this role a year, and you know, I as much as I'd love to think I move the barometer, one thing I hear from everybody I talk to in K-12 who's in kind of that tech coach or digital coach role is they say our teachers, our first and second year teachers, really need this. They might be digital natives, quote unquote, but they're not digital. I know how to leverage this technology in meaningful ways with my students. There's not like a clever little name for that. I don't know. That got really long-winded, a lot of hyphens there. But you get the idea. They're not ready to use it meaningfully. And actually, a lot of them come into our program year one. You know, they're in this foundation block, we call it. And they're actually kind of cynical towards technology. And they're really not in a place where a lot of them don't feel like using it. And we've tried to make a big, really blowout event early on in that foundations block where we really celebrate all these unique ways tech is being used in K-12 and we see where it's going in K-12. And we've turned a lot of attitudes with that, but at the same time, some of them still are like, I think there are better ways to do it. And I think tech is more of a distraction. So it's an interesting conversation. And sometimes they're right. Sometimes tech, you know, is improperly used and is a distraction, but they sometimes come out very cynically. And I don't know if that's because in their high school career, maybe they saw tech use, you know, in ways that weren't meaningful and just felt like a tack on. I don't know.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Is we're gonna start to dive into the theoretical here, and I was gonna ask you why you think that is. And I'm trying to imagine. So, I mean, from my perspective, I deal with students every day who are in transition from a non-digital school and now are in a one-to-one environment, and you know, we get a lot of pushback from students, which I don't think we were expecting or prepared for.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've struggled a lot with what causes that. And I think you'll appreciate the analogy I've come up with that I've sort of agreed to. And I don't even know if I've said it on the show before, but I've often said that the reason my students struggle so much with technology and also just struggle with the idea of struggling is because they grew up with Xbox and I grew up with Nintendo. And and I say that and people think I'm joking, but then I start to explain, I'm like, no, but listen, if I wanted to play Mario, it was not as simple as hit the power button and it was going to work. There was effort involved. I had to actually like take the cartridge out and blow in it and then had to like have a piece of tissue paper rolled up the right number of times to put it so it wasn't all the way down, but most of the way down. And then I close in and then I would make sure I like closed it softly because if you close it too hard, it'd reset itself again. Like there was a process to get the game going. We grew up in an era where technology didn't just work. And nowadays, technology just works. And if it doesn't work, you toss it out. We expected it to take extra time to do things with technology. They look at technology as something that is going to save them time. And so those moments where it doesn't, and in a lot of cases, they see teachers struggling with technology or trying new things and it not working perfectly, they look at it as a waste of time is kind of how I feel about it. But I don't know if that's the perfect description or if you could see maybe a connection to that.
Yeah, I think that's a really great analogy. And yes, you are correct. I do love that analogy. I'm actually going to take a second to take a left turn on that because, your analogy reminded me of a really phenomenal joke I saw on the internet. So if you'll indulge me, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
I was reading a forum one day, and the gentleman who invented the cartridge had passed away. And so the person said, "Hey, I don't know if you've heard it. This gentleman, I can't remember his name, godfather of the cartridge, has passed." And the very next comment on it was, "Are you sure he's dead? Did you try taking him out and blowing on him and putting him back in?" Which is a very macabre joke. I realize that kind of yes. dark, but at the same time, like, everybody's like, "Well, I guess this thread's over. You've just won, sir." You know, it's kind of game, set, match. But anyways, let's get back to education. I think that's why we're here. I think you've got a great point. I think one thing that you hit on is the struggle, and I could definitely relate to the struggle. You know, with that, you know, we definitely did need to tinker, figure out, and they are used to things come to you. And so a lot of times when we'd introduce a new tech and they hit a brick wall with that tech, sometimes I didn't see that willingness to struggle. And that's just something, I think you're right. I don't mean to sound like a, you know, get off my lawn old man who in my day we had to, you know, figure out why it didn't work and work through it. But I do think there is a little bit of that ubiquity, and especially we show them a lot of new tools, a lot of tools where they're kind of foreigners too. And sometimes we can be our own worst enemies on trying to just throw a new tool at them just to do it. So the intentionality and showing them that the juice is worth the squeeze too, sometimes is something that I don't know if we talk about that. Some teachers don't tell their students why, you know, we're leveraging the tech, and sometimes students just want to know the answer to that question, but they don't ask it. And so that also, I think, is a downfall that I've been guilty of. And I know that's something that I tried to reinforce, you know, having kind of reflected and realized that when I'd work with somebody and say, you know, your students really do deserve to know why. And if we can't answer that, why they couldn't do it way X or Y or Z, we need to step back and maybe ask ourselves why.
Yeah, I think you're right, that asking why. And I would make, and I don't know that I want to get on this path right now, but I would make the argument that we have, as an educational system, taught them not to ask that question early on because you do what a teacher says and you don't question it. But I'm not gonna get all the way into the industrial revolutionary model of education that we all live in, at least not yet, maybe in a little bit. I have one more question about your job that I want to ask.
Sure.
Before we get into my main questions of my guests. And so you are in this unique position to be able to talk to pre-service teachers, people who are about to go in the field. You have experience in using technology in the classroom. What is the wisdom you impart on these students? What is it they hired you to tell them? That question kind of got away from me a little bit. My bad.
No, I totally hear what you're saying. And I think at the end of the day, I tell them, I said, you know, my title has instructional technology in it, but the one thing we tell them is, you know, whether it doesn't matter if it's instructional technology, it doesn't matter if you're just, you know, going all out to give them a unique experience. It doesn't matter if you're empowering them to, you know, decide what they want to do or getting them fired up about a cause or a real world problem. The big thing that we try to impart to them is just, you know, fall in love with the challenge of reaching the kids. I think that's what we tell them. Fall in love with that struggle and fall in love with that idea, because that's going to be what keeps you going. Instructional technology is one of many ways to do it. But one thing I do tell them is I say, you know, forget my title. You know, I'll definitely help you make sure that this works in the classroom. But at the end of the day, I just want to make sure that you're excited about what you're bringing to the classroom and that, you know, your students, your staff, whatever you see your future role being, is that, you know, you have the tools to approach it in new ways, evolve with the times and you know, look at each day as a challenge to say, how can I, you know, reach them in new ways. I think that's the big thing that I take away from my job. And we just try to get them fired up about teaching at the end of the day.
I like that. Using the technology or whatever vehicle you have available to reach them in new ways. And that is, I think, a good method to take with the technology in the classroom. So I can support that. I like it. You're doing a good job, it seems like, from what I can tell in the last 18 minutes. I think you're good at what you're doing.
Okay. Well, I'm at least good at faking it on a podcast, you know, at the very least.
So
yeah.
If nothing else, you are good at that. which is actually the story of my podcast, is me just faking it on a podcast. So before I do have one other thing I wanted to talk about before we get to my normal questions, and sure. It may end up being relevant, but I did want to talk a little bit about your Ignite speech. Sure. Because I thought it was very cool. I thought it was very different. You opened with, you said that you like to sing, and you opened your Ignite with, I think, what felt like 3.5 minutes of singing. And I don't mean that in an insulting kind of way. I know, having written my Ignite, that every second feels like a minute. Like, every second is so critical. And you spent a good amount of time singing, which I thought showed a level of just calm that I did not have myself. So could you talk to me a little bit about your Ignite and what it was like, what your content was first, and then maybe a little bit what that experience was like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was my second Ignite. Did one 2 or 3 years ago, wherever, I think it was Atlanta or Philadelphia. I think it was Phil. I can't remember. Anyway, it's not important. This was my second one, and it was funny. I think I'm flip-flopping the order you gave me, like the experience of it and the content, but I'll get there either way. I'll get to both.
That's fine.
Yeah. So the first one, I like, and maybe you can relate, you know, to this, but my first one, I had scripted out to the nanosecond. I like had it planned. I was reading it to myself in my car. Like, that's, I go to work and I'd run through it. I'd come back. I finally decided day of, I was too nervous, and I had like actually the sheet of it in front of me. I set it down. We had a podium at that one 3 years ago. We did not when you and I did it, which actually suited my style for this one better. But this one, I took the complete opposite approach. It was that the other one was driven by timing and jokes and like poignant moments where I had to hit a mark and the slide had to change. This one was, when the picture changes, okay, I'm wrapping up that thought. I'm going to the next thought. So it was very much the presentation cued me. And so I actually just had some talking points about some game-based learning experiences that I had used, I had worked with other teachers to implement, I had gotten excited about and seen implemented other places. And basically it was just to, you know, try to, anybody in the audience or anybody who watched that later, get them fired up about what was possible and what's coming. And so mine focused a lot on just experiences that were coming, had occurred, I think will occur soon in the future, and just talking about them and getting people fired up about the concept. The one thing I think about is it doesn't matter how great that content is. I need to do something else to make it stick. So both attention grabbers that I used were songs. I performed about 30 to 45 seconds of Thriller for my one 3 years ago. And this one I did the opening song from Circle of Life from Lion King. I could not think of the name of it. And I can say nothing else other than my dream is to do something different in an Ignite every time. And so the first one, I was like, I'll sing. The second one, I'm like, what if I make other people sing? I don't know if I ever do a third one. They might not let me back. Maybe this guy, just all he does is gets up there and sings, and then, you know, everybody just tunes him out for the rest. But the whole goal with that was, you know, I like to just end with like a terrible pun or terrible joke. So I had a really terrible pun at the end of my Thriller one. And then at the end of this one, of course, it had Rafiki holding a Pokeball. And so that segued into how Pokemon Go had been changing lives. So that's kind of my experience. That got really long winded. But that's kind of what occurred.
I think that's a good, so that is a very good description. I definitely fully scripted mine, to the T, and which makes it odd because having done it, I know I messed up in a couple places.
Right.
But the audience would have no way of knowing that.
No clue.
It's not like I messed up so bad that it was obvious to them. I knew I did not hit the words I wanted to hit. And interestingly enough, I kind of stepped away from my script as I got on stage. I had like this moment of clarity about three people before me. I just, all the nerves washed away, and I went on stage and said, you know what? I know it well enough. I can make some changes as I go. And so I was reading the audience and doing that thing, which was surprising to me at the time. But actually, at the time, I don't remember anything that happened. I've just had to watch it again. I totally blacked out on stage. But anyways, the other pun you used that I particularly enjoyed because it cracked me up when even live and after the fact was Kakuna Ratata.
Oh, and yeah.
That, I cried. Which, for my audience who don't know what we're talking about, there are two Pokemon called Kakuna and Ratata, and he made a joke about Hakuna Matata. It was very funny. You had to see it. Go watch it if you can. It's great.
I wish I could take credit for that one. That one totally stolen off of Twitter. So I'd love to take credit, but I will say that was when I saw it. I'm like, done. This is in.
You did give credit in your presentation. To be fair, you credited it with the original tweet. So I thought that was a good move as well. So that made me laugh. But no, I liked your presentation. I thought it was good. You know, I'm not. One of the things I will say is I'm a skeptic of VR in the classroom. I'm a big time skeptic, and I'm very tech driven. I'm very tech focused. I believe in technology, and I just don't yet buy the VR in the classroom. I don't buy it in a practical sense because of cost barriers. And I understand Google Cardboard eliminates some of those and everything else, but it doesn't. And let's be honest, it's not even remotely the same experience. Anyone who's ever used a Vive will never tell you that a Cardboard is VR again. And I don't buy it from the cost prohibitive factor, and I don't buy it from, I get the engagement. I just don't yet see that it is doing something that is an improvement. I see where it's a replacement or an equivalent, but I don't see that it's an improvement. With that said, I really enjoyed your presentation specifically on the game-based mechanics and the way students were learning in a game environment. I thought that was really some powerful examples you gave to get me to buy into that part of it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I tell people, my wife and I don't know if I mentioned this in the presentation, my wife and I taught a summer school Minecraft course for 3 summers, and it was really magical. I also say we are still married after 3 summers of co-teaching together, which I think, I don't know if people applaud as they listen to the podcast, but you should be applauding right now. Thank you. That's something to try out. You know, if you're an educator and your wife's an educator, try co-teaching during a summer school session. It's a good test of your marriage. We came out unscathed on the other side, but anyways, that's another side. But it was really amazing. You know, year one, we did Minecraft and we just kind of said, we were figuring it out as we went, like a lot of, you know, first times that you do anything in education. So we were just like, build a society. It'll be great. And, it was terrible. They were, you know, burning each other down with hot lava and like, you know, stealing each other's stuff and, you know, destroying each other's houses. And, you know, we said, build something, and they would build something for 10 minutes and get bored and want to go back to burning each other with lava. And it took us 2 to 3 years to really figure out how to motivate them. But once we got them, and really what it took is uniting them against a common enemy, which is really kind of sad and dark again. But we said, hey, you're a society, but 2 societies have crash landed. Session 1 and Session 2 of Minecraft. We are going to crown a greatest society. Who can, on this island, create a new from nothing society? And the conversations were incredible. We had students, I think I mentioned in the presentation, making low-income housing for students who died and lost all their stuff. They needed a place to stay for the night. They instituted plant two trees for every one tree rule on their own. We didn't talk about conservation. They lived conservation. They decided on a conservation policy. They decided what monument would represent their society. They had to choose something that was symbolic of who they were or what they did. One girl wrote a song, like they wrote a national anthem. She composed it on her piano and they would play it each morning, as their society like launched in the server. I can't make this stuff up. Like that's a real thing that happened. I think I've got it saved somewhere on my computer. I should try to pull it up. We can wrap up the podcast with it, but, just really, really unique things that I would love to say I could have pulled off with a simulation, you know, and taught those things, but there were things that we didn't even intend to teach that just happened from experience. And that's one of my big takeaways from game-based learning. It lets you step into somebody's shoes, and lets you live those things and empathize with others. And it's been powerful for me growing up, even as a kid, when we were blowing on those cartridges, that a lot of those games, I think, did inspire me to go into teaching English, truthfully. So.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. And I agree with you. I get it. I get the connections. I love that real world learning they're getting in a virtual world. And I think there's a lot of really powerful learning happening and connections to be made there. With that said, something you said, I feel like triggers a lot of teachers. And you said specifically that a lot of the learning we didn't even plan. We didn't even mean to teach it. And in a classroom environment where you have standards to meet and everything else, that can scare a lot of teachers. So what is your pushback against them when they say, like, well, wait a minute, I know I need to get them to learn this. I don't have time to accidentally let them learn something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm one who I do love game-based learning. I mentioned I teach a course on video games and learning, but at the same time, I will be the first to tell you games aren't the answer for reaching objective X or Y. There's not a great experience that, you know, can be developed for that or doesn't already exist out there. And a lot of, frankly, a lot of, you know, game-based learning games that are designed for actually learning are absolute garbage. They really are. They're designed to be a, you know, we call them chocolate covered broccoli, where you get an answer right and then you're rewarded by getting to do something you actually wanted to do, you know, whereas the students learned by doing something they wanted to do. So the skill they practiced was directly transferable into the lesson learned. And that's what they were doing in the game rather than, you know, back in our day, you know, I'm sounding like a grizzled old man when I'm not actually that old, but back in our days, like Algebra Blasters, you know, you get the math, you shoot the math problem to get the right answer. Oh God,
I remember that game.
Yes. So, you know, it's just like a totally disconnect between what you do in the game and how that relates to real life, right? You don't shoot, you know, math problems, you know, to figure out math. Whereas in like a game like the Radix Endeavor, you actually use math to reinforce these buildings and this crumbling society in the game. If you're going to discover how this species is dying, you literally scoop its poop to figure that out. And for some reason, kids love scooping poop, even in the digital world. Now, I'd love for them to go out and scoop poop, you know, and learn that in real life. But practicality wise, we're not going to be able to get 120 sixth graders to scoop enough poop to analyze. Unless you've got some really, really flatulent wildlife, you know, by your school, it's just not going to happen. So, you know, games are a great way to give them this unique experience that is hard to replicate because of logistics, because of just the limits of reality, whatever it might be. The pushback, I guess I would say, is I don't try to force it in a situation it doesn't apply.
Okay, I think that's good. I think that's a good reply, because I think a lot of times we look at various tools, various educational methods, whatever the new jargon or buzzword is, and people try to act like it's a panacea and it's going to fix everything. And rarely, if ever, is that true. I don't think, you know, even taking a broad topic like technology is not the solution. It is not, there is not a the solution. So I think that's good. I think that's the right way to look at it. And when it's in the right place is when it can have the most value.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I definitely, in my presentation, want to say people, you know, take a peek, and this is something to add to your toolkit. And I think that's something that we all want to think about when we're looking at any practice that we want to implement. You know, be open to it. See if it's a good fit for what your goals are for your students. And obviously don't try to force something that doesn't belong. You know, that's once again, the students can see right through it. They'll ask that why question we talked about, you know, 15, 20 minutes ago. And if you don't have a good answer for the why, the students are questioning, you know, your methods.
Yeah, I think that's good. And God knows teachers get terrified if students question them.
Right. And I think you had a good point. It's good for them to ask why, but if we don't have a good response besides, well, that's what I told you to do, that's concerning.
Yes, agreed. All right. Well, I like it. I like it. I think it's a good reply. You took the pushback well, and let's move. We spent a lot of time actually talking about your job and what you do, and more than I would say I usually do in a show. But I was fascinated by it, and I think it was an interesting perspective. So I appreciate that. But I do want to get into my main questions for my guests. And my first question for all of my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Oof. Oh, wow. That is a good one. Biggest question facing education. That is a dandy. Let's go with, I think the biggest problem facing education today, I'm just cycling through like 20 that, you know, I can think of, but I think there's a little bit of fear of taking a left turn right now. And I'm kind of going macro, and I'll probably try to tighten this up micro if that helps. I don't know how other people tackle this one, but I think we are seeing a lot of innovative practices right now, and we are afraid to take a left turn, and a lot of these practices that I think we know are the right move were afraid to take them. I'll give a few examples. One of the big things is getting rid of just, you know, the standard grading practices. That is a left turn. And, a lot of districts are trying to hedge on that. Another big one would be, going to like a standards-based grading. Another one would be flipping more to a student-centered learning or doing away with grade levels. There's a lot of these ideas that we are seeing research on. There's a lot of ideas that we know ourselves. We hate giving letter grades. There's a lot of practices we know we should be making sure our students walk out with these requisite skills. And at the same time, there's this fear, I think, of pushback. And I think, we just got done talking about pushback. We're terrified of that. When I pitch, working in game-based learning, I'm not afraid of pushback, just because I know, there in moderation, it can be a good thing. Now here I'm saying we need to take a giant left turn, right? So it is a bit hypocritical, I realize. But at the same time, I think we see all these things on the edge of the cliff, but we're afraid to throw ourselves off that. And I think that's the big thing right now. I would say fear is the biggest problem in education. We are afraid of doing what we know is right. And that is a macro point of view. So I realize like you and I can't tomorrow walk into our respective district or college and say, hey, just spoiler alert, I'm not giving a grade this year. That won't work, right? But so on a micro level, how does that happen? I think that's another good question. And I tend to ramble, so I'm going to stop and see your thoughts on that.
So it's interesting that you take a very macro view in saying that fear is our problem. Because it is, I would argue that it's the root cause of a significant number of our problems. So I agree with you completely. I think my question for you is what exactly are we afraid of? What are we really afraid of at a macro level is going to happen? Like we sit here and talk about the power of failure for our students and we like say the phrase, like, what's the worst that could happen? And yet we are terrified to do anything. We're paralyzed by our fear, arguably. So why? What is it we are so afraid of?
Yeah, I think it actually, it is failure at one level. When you get it from a macro view, a district is afraid of being the first district in their area, their state, their, whatever it is, their country, to be the one who switches over, and it is an abject failure. But at the same time, I don't know how you ignore all of the, there's so many reasons why we know it would be so good to go to something that is growth focused, for grades, or we know it's something better to go where we're not worried so much about what age your student is, but rather what abilities they're still honing. But at the same time, we've seen a number of people go through the system and say, well, I turned out just fine. And those are the same people who, well, they got their first, they got their first F in college and they were devastated because they never got an F. I never forget. I think it was Jeff Charbonneau. He had the closing keynote a few ISTEs ago. And he talked about that. A girl finally, her senior year, got an F and she like had to be away from school for a few days. And she's like, we failed that girl. She didn't fail that test. We failed her. We never pushed her to the point where she felt challenged. And suddenly she ran into her first challenge and she had a breakdown. And that is the fault of the school. The school never let her get uncomfortable. And I think you said it well, we encourage our students to get uncomfortable, but yet we as a society, as a districts, as colleges, as universities, as, independent agencies that try to support, are afraid of that same leap. So it is ironic. I think you have pointed out the great irony.
Yeah, it is. I don't know where we point, because it is a macro issue, but at the same time, what I always argue is that if we don't try to address the macro issues at the micro level, they never change. So we have to address it in some way. So what would you advocate we do about it?
So I think one thing, and I'll bring this down micro to something I'm trying with my fall semester class, and I don't know if this is the answer, but one thing I just want to instill, and I think this will encourage people, is I want them to fall in love with the learning, not the grade. And so I think that's all of our goals. I'm not saying that I'm doing something revolutionary. That's definitely not true, but I'm trying to eliminate all references to the grade except where I absolutely legally have to in my syllabus. That's one thing I'm doing. So in there, the first class I'm actually dedicating to, these pre-service librarians, just telling them like all the magical things that happen when we learn and acquire new skills. Like we're doing digital tools, but I don't know if we're going to touch a digital tool. Like I'm going to go into the neurology of like what happens when we connect new synapses. I'm going to go into the first thing I'm going to show. This is again, the game-based learning nerdery, but they're going to actually do skill trees. And what I mean by that is they're going to create a character. This is my nerdy video game person coming out, but they're going to create an avatar, as cliche as that is to open a class, but they are actually going to have skill trees that develop as they meet certain skills and standards in the class. And I want them to see the skill tree grow from their character. And the reason I want them to do that, because it's crazy, a skill tree that you and I played in our video games that we had to blow into to make sure they worked in our old, Nintendos and whatnot. They did a great job of showing us how we had progressed in the game. Like I opened up my character's skill tree. I saw that I had made such and such progress. I had proven that I was this good and I'd earned these abilities. I want them to see the same thing. And it's amazing because those skill trees, you lay them over, the neural synapses that we make when we learn. And it's kind of the same idea, right? We're literally forming these bonds in our brain. And when you start to think about, holy crap, look at all these synapses I connected, and you stop thinking about, hey, did I get enough to get an A in this class? It's kind of an amazing thing when you're thinking about, I know that things are happening up there. I know that these are things that I now have ingrained in myself for life. I think it's a powerful thing. And that's not going to maybe change a politician or a board member or a parent's mind, but if you change the kids' minds, that is kind of the grassroots thing that could make it really powerful. I think when the kids stop saying, what grade did I get? That's going to be huge. The parents might still say it, but those kids are eventually going to grow up and they're going to say, well, I don't care what grade they got. Show me what you can do. Show me the skill. Do you have a video of you doing that skill? Great. Cause they hopefully are going to have those experiences. So I don't want it to sound like I'm thinking this will all change when like a whole generation dies off. But we can at least have the kids be the spokespeople for these changes.
Now, I agree. I think that we can point to that as a place because you're right. I think that, grades are a problem. And I love the idea of a skill tree. And even thinking about the skill tree as, what it taught us as kids about, not only how we grow and progress and improve, but also the choices we make and having an impact and consequences and things like that. So I get that. And I kind of, on a conversation about video games, I kind of worry a little bit that the modernization of microtransactions has completely eliminated that component of video games, which I think is one of the really critical learning things in video games. Cause now there are no consequences for your choices. You just pay 75 cents and you undo whatever you just did.
Great point.
Which is, again, we're not even on education at that point, but whatever. I like that idea of the skill tree, and I think that's cool. And I really like the idea of getting away from the grades. It's something that I have advocated strong for in my own school and in my own practice. And I have seen major improvements in student engagement and perseverance and things like that because of that. But again, another topic where we get a lot of pushback. When you start to mess with teachers' grades, they get really angry. I don't know if you've had this experience, if you've tried to have these conversations with people. And I think back to my interview with Rick Wormley, where we talked much about his article, Recorder Zero 60. And people get really angry when you suggest that a grade is not the best thing that's ever been invented. And so again, I'm going to ask, how do you come back to the pushback?
Yeah, I think you kind of highlighted it. You talked about what you saw in your students, when you started de-emphasizing those. And I think that's really what's again is going to move the needle. I think we need to get these kids on video. We need to get them on record. We need them up in board meetings. We need them in places where large amounts of people are hearing them say, I have no idea what my grade in this class is right now, but I can tell you this. I can do this skill. I can do X. I can do Y. I can show you this thing. Like, I made this end product that is impacting people. That is a clear representation of my ability to, you know, persuade an audience, my ability to critically, you know, combine multiple mediums to convey a message, whatever it is. I'm naming ELA standards because that was my jam. and so when they start to say, like, I have no clue what letter, what number I have, but I absolutely can tell you about my growth and I can show you my growth. I think that's what's going to move it. And maybe, you know, you and I, we act like we're these underground heroes right now, but maybe the problem is we're not, you know, we're not sharing, you know, the student's perspective on it. And maybe that's what it's going to take. I think is students staying to these adults. Cause I'm just going to tell you what, a politician looks really bad if he says, I don't want to get rid of grades. And there's like 30 students on the local news saying, yeah, we don't give a crap about grades. They're holding us back. You know, it's really bad publicity. Not that politicians should have the power to say what they do, but we know that a lot of times they do get to drive things.
All right. I like it. I'm going to stick with it. I like the idea of bringing student voice into the conversation of grading. I think that's a really good idea. So I like that. That's good. Good pushback. I like it. You're keeping with me and I appreciate that. That's good. All right, we're going to go to my second question. This one's not as hard, and you might have already touched on it, so it shouldn't be too bad. But my second question for all my guests is, what is something you are doing that you wish all teachers would do?
Oh, okay. What am I doing that I wish all teachers would do? One thing that I'm doing, I think if it comes down to anything, because I could sit here and I could go down the game-based learning thing, because that's a big thing what I do. You know, on Twitter, I'd say 60% of my tweets are probably about game-based learning, just because it was a big part of my life. But maybe I'd go macro. I keep saying that. Go macro might need to be the name of this episode. The macro view would be, I am constantly surveilling the world for things that can come back into my practice. And I think it doesn't matter if you're in education or if you are a real estate agent. I'm saying that because it feels like there's tons of for sale signs in my neighborhood. I don't know if that's because of me. I don't want to read into it. You know, whatever your job is, chef, but you keep looking for inspiration in the world around you. That's something that was instilled in me very early on in my life, you know, even before I went into education, and then just, you know, during my education and now as a teacher. That's some of the sagest advice is always be looking for inspiration. And it could be anything. You know, you see a TV show you love. How can you replicate that feeling, that excitement, the joy from that TV show in your classroom or in your trainings or in your professional development, whatever it is. And, you know, I went to a great ISTE session about 3-4 years ago, and the guy said, I always have my smartphone at the ready, and I film anything I think I could potentially corral into a really cool teachable moment. And so he filmed one time, he was a science teacher, he filmed an empty parking garage because the airflow was doing something really unique that was teaching a science concept. And he made up something on the spot. He's like, I pulled it out and I started explaining it, but you couldn't hear me because it was too loud because the airflow. He's like, but I said, screw it, I'll film it and I'll record over it later, you know, in a program, you know, and I'll put it out to my students. But you know, that just reinforced something I think I had forgotten about for the longest time is we've got these great inspirations all around us, people, pop culture, nature, you know, just everything that around us, you know, we've got this really great world, and bringing that back into our classroom is so crucial, because if we just go with what's in the text, you know, our students don't feel connected to it. And even if students aren't connected to things like, you know, even if they don't like video games, they sure as heck know I'm pouring my heart and soul into it when they see how nerdy and video gamey I'm making this digital tools course. It's somehow more, I feel like, video gamey than my video games and learning course, which is on. But you know, they know that I'm putting my heart and soul into it, and I'm encouraging them to draw from anything in their life and put it back into their assessments. And I think that's important. I think that's a really crucial lesson. And I know a ton of teachers are doing this, but I guess my message to them is don't ever forget that. That's such a crucial part of what makes us not able to be replaced by robots someday. Like, if there's anything that robots can't, like, take in the natural splendor of the world and all the cool things that happen and magically, like, turn it into this crazy lesson. If they can, then yes, the robots deserve to replace us. That took a weird turn. Sorry.
No, it always ends up there, if we're being honest. Okay. So it's interesting because a lot of times we talk about those real world connections and making those real world connections for students, but you're talking about making those real world connections for yourself. And I think using that to engage the students, I think is a great way to look at it. You know, we say that great teachers, you know, get the students to bring their real world experiences, but the power of bringing our own is something else too, that I think is easy to overlook. I think probably a lot of people do overlook that. That's a great idea.
Yeah. I had a student, he said to me, as probably my first or second year teaching, he said, "Mr. Spike, we don't know anything about you." I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, other teachers, all they do is talk about themselves. I feel like they spend the first 10, 15 minutes of their class talking about themselves. You just jump right into the lesson." And at first I was like, well, man, I'm being a really good teacher. I'm not wasting your time with my life. But at the same time, I realized they wanted to know. They wanted to know what got me fired up, you know, what got me passionate. And clearly, if I wasn't talking about it in that beginning 10 minutes, it wasn't coming through in how I taught either. And that really stuck with me. I was like, that's kind of embarrassing. You know, I don't want to be just that guy who taught ninth grade. Oh, what was his name? I want to be that guy where they're like, do you remember he has to do this, this, and this? He's a guy who's obsessed with that, but it was super funny. And one time we brought him like 1,000 of those because he loves them just to mess with it. You know, that's the person who had an impact on him. You know, granted, maybe they can't tell me what a gerund is, you know, from composition class, but they at least, you know, I had an impact on them and they knew that, you know, they need to bring that same energy to what they do someday. You know, by the way, if anybody's wondering what a gerund is, it is a verb ending in ing that acts as a noun in a sentence. So there you go. Gerunds. Good stuff.
So important. I don't know how I ever lived without that noun.
My favorite word to teach, gerund.
Yeah. I always loved the like random things like that you would teach kids because you knew it always stuck with them. Like whether they wanted it or not.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I could not remember learning about gerunds, but darn it, I made sure everybody remembered gerunds that came through my class, even though totally not really that important in their life.
Cool. All right. I got one more. More question and we are going to wrap this thing up and we're coming right up to the hour. So we are nailing our time.
Yes.
All right. So my last question for all my guests is, who is the greatest teacher you ever had?
Wow. Okay. That is really tricky. All right. I'm going to probably cheat and try to say two, but I'll start with one that was very important. And this is for a number of reasons. And it's just also a really great story, this teacher. So her name is Miss Nelson. And what's really fascinating is I had her for 3 years. We had when I entered the second grade, they started a second, third, and fourth grade multi-age classroom. They no longer have it. They probably saw what happened to me after I went through it and said, no, no, thank you. But had her for 3 years. And those are some formative years of your education. You know, like I feel like kindergarten, first grade, you're still like really kind of confused by this whole school thing. You know, you make some crafts and, you know, you try to outline some letters, but you're still not sure who you are. And second, third, and fourth is really when you start diving in. I feel like you're more autonomously making things that demonstrate a little bit about yourself, or you're getting out of your shell a little bit. And she was a phenomenal teacher to have. She really, truly, you know, believed in us, empowered us, created community so well. That's one big takeaway I had from her, is the sense of community she created. And she did that by first showing you how much she respected you and how much she wanted to learn about you, and then asking your classmates how much they knew about you. And I think that was special. The other thing that's unique about that class is my wife, when I was a fourth grader, so my last year in there, was a second grader in that class. And she and I did not interact at all. Like, didn't even know each other existed. But it's kind of fascinating. And so we joke with her. I actually got to go back and give a talk at my high school or my district, and she was in the audience, and I got to give her a shout out for introducing us, for the first time, with whether that's accurate or not. But, yeah, kind of a fun fact. And one story I really enjoy, I work this into, you know, I'm not like a huge keynoter. I've given just a couple and very modest places. I'm not like, I'm not the kind of person who would charge for a keynote. Let's just put it that way, Brad. Like, not, you don't need to pay me to do a keynote. I'm like, yeah, I'll do one. How many people? Cool. All right. 10. I'll just call it a keynote. It's not a keynote. But you know, one story I like to tell, is one involving her. So we told her one day, I think we were about second or third grade. It was St. Patrick's Day. We just learned about kind of the mythology of it. And we told her that we were going to go out and catch a leprechaun. And so a group of us went out there and we were hunting. And of course we looked down by we had this lovely creek that ran the boundary of our playground. And so we were looking all over this creek, which sounds actually really dangerous out loud right now, like unsupervised we were by this creek, but we're fine. So I kid you not, bell's about to ring. We find this gross piece of kind of like plasticky, like mush. And it somehow, I swear to you, it looked like the jacket. Like kind of greenish black, like it was more black than green, let's be honest, but it looked like a leprechaun's vest somehow. And we were over the moon. We ran back and we ran up with this gross, like mud covered speckled piece of plastic. We ran up to Mrs. Nelson and we said, "You'll never believe it. We found a leprechaun's jacket." And she could have in that moment done so many things. She could have right then and there been like, "That's a piece of plastic, you know, that's nothing." But she looked and she realized, I think she had a choice, and she chose to say, "I am so impressed. You have to tell the whole class about this. Tell us how you found it. What were your strategies? You know what?" And she turned it into this moment where we were suddenly like, I was like, "Dang it. She's having us practice speaking and listening skills. Son of a biscuit," you know? And looking back on it as like a teacher, like, how did she? And so we were going on and on about this, and we like did a follow-up activity where we had to plot like our path and course to find, and I was just like floored looking back on that and how she took this little moment and she could have quashed it and gotten back to the lesson, but instead she ran with it. And it just stuck with me. So, you know, I always tell people, you know, when you're teaching, don't be afraid to let your students chase the leprechaun. Cause that's what she let us do. She let us, you know, live out the fantasy. You know, she knew it wasn't real, but she realized it was a great moment for us and a moment we wouldn't forget. I'm actually going to stick with her. I was going to segue into another teacher, but I think that's good. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. I like it. I think it's a solid moment. Like you said, it's that teacher you remember, right? It's that one that brought themselves into the room, but let you bring yourself as well. I think that's something powerful that you can't replace. You can't automate even. You can't make a machine that's going to accomplish that goal.
Yeah, the machine would have like weighed the risk reward and would have been like, "Nope, we're going to continue on with standard 3-1."
And also go wash your hands.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The other thing they would have done, yeah, has been like, "Yeah, I could tell you right now, I've analyzed it. That is not a leprechaun jacket. And you may need to, you know, take a day off of school. We don't know what was on that thing." So yeah, that's a very fair point. You cannot replace teachers, because what machine is going to let that moment happen?
Yeah. And it's that same thing you said before about bringing that splendor of the real world. And granted, this is a piece of literal garbage, but it was, you know, it is bringing that real world moment into the classroom and making it a learning experience. And that, you know, I so often marvel at the power of improvisation. Really what you're talking about improvisational skills and how powerful that is in a classroom. You can't teach that stuff. It just takes time. It just takes practice. And, so often those are the moments that really drive home learning for our kids, is something that you didn't plan for and you just roll with it on the fly.
Yeah. I think a lot of teachers make the mistake of thinking they need to be funny. And really what they need to do is, like you said, they need to be able to, I think, more in the moment, handle a situation where they need to decide, you know, how can we riff on this to make it a really great moment? Because kids don't remember teachers, I think, because they're funny. They remember them because they rolled with the moment and they let the moment happen because they realized it was good for culture of the class. It was good for the community of the class. It was maybe actually, you know, there was a really cool place they could get to or conversation they could have. But you know, it's not so much it was funny. It was like, that was, you know, that was a really cool moment. It made me feel something. It made me laugh, made me think, made me just be like, "Oh my gosh, are we really talking about this? I didn't think we could talk about this in school, but here we are," you know?
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful place to end it. Let's make sure we keep talking about the things we don't think we're supposed to talk about in school. I think that is, if we boil it down to one message, I think that's our takeaway for today.
We nailed it.
We nailed it. I like it. John, thank you so much for joining me. I really do appreciate it. It was a really, really good talk. You know, we literally ran almost right to the hour mark. So I really appreciate that. How can my audience get a hold of you if they have questions or want to reach out to you?
Absolutely. So my Twitter handle is at Mr_JSpike. Turns out there's a lot of people with Spike in their Twitter handles, and I was pretty low on the totem pole there. And then my work email, which is probably best way to get to me, is spikej@uww.edu. That's a great one, shorter than like my personal one, which is a little more complicated. So spikej@uww.edu works. So those would be the two best ways, I'd say, Twitter, and then also email.
All right. That's excellent. And I will, obviously that'll be included in the show notes, guys. And John, again, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for talking to me, man.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brad. It's been a blast.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, and thank you so much for the Minecraft project details, which I actually used with my students this last week, or last couple weeks, and it was a great experience. To connect with Jonathan, you can find him on Twitter, he's at Mr_JSpike, or email him at spikej@uww.edu. Links to both of those things are in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Schreffler, and I love to hear from you guys there. If you would like to be a guest on the show, that's also the best way to connect as well. Or you can check out the feedback page on my website, which gives you options for feedback as well, such as a Flipgrid page and some other messaging tools as well. You can find that at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, don't let fear prevent you from making change that is good for kids.
Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.